Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety, January 16th at 1 o'clock. Welcome. At this time, we'll go through with a call to order and approval of the minutes. So moved. Senator Brown, so moved. Now we'll have a follow-up from our previous meetings. Do we have to vote on it? Kerry says we have to vote on it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Well, they're not here. Follow-up on previous meetings. I think we, Mr. Childs, you okay with me? Okay. And
thank
I'll
you,
turn
Chair.
It over to Mr. Childs with a follow-up.
On the web, I've included a report. There was a request from Representative McNeil about recruitment with IDS, and I've included a report with numbers from IDS showing their recruitment from the counties for fiscal year 12-13 and then for the last five fiscal years, too.
Any comments from the on the report? At this time, I excuse me, like to recognize our Sergeant of Arms. On the House side today, we have Mr. Bill Bass and Mr. Barry Moore present, counted for. On the Senate, Sergeant of Arms, we have Mr. Caton Lewis and Mr. Billy Fritcher, behind me. You've got my back today. Thank you. Any other under the follow-up? Representative Burr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to follow up with you on a previous meeting concerning the motor fleet, see if you know where that stands at today and what we can expect to get an update on that.
Okay, thank you. I had conversations last night with DPS, and they've assured me that they are working with Department Administration and that there seems to be a compromise worked out and that things are moving, and that at this point in time, that our February meeting, we will have a final report.
Very good. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Okay, and Mr. Petit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, for some of you have calendars at your seats. This is some enticement to go on our site visits before the oversight meeting. Last month we had some turnips. This time we're having calendars. For those of you who didn't go but still would like a calendar, I'm sure we can work something out. So sort of stay tuned for next month.
And this time I'd like to recognize Representative John Faircloth to kind of give us what the tour yesterday was about, since you had high remarks this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was quite an interesting tour. If you weren't able to make it and another opportunity comes, I would encourage you to. We learned quite a bit about how things are produced by correction enterprises and then how they are delivered around the state to various places. We also went through the pharmacy, and I had been to a meeting last week among some business leaders, and we were talking about how the jobs have changed out there that, for instance, in manufacturing, one of the leaders said that he now had four employees and about 35 or 40 robot machines to do what about 200 employees had done before, which is a tremendous loss in number of people with jobs. But it's the future. That's the way things are moving. We saw a sample of that yesterday in the pharmacy where they had to cut back on some positions, but they bought three robotic machines to fill the prescriptions, and it was doing a tremendous job, very accurately, and really, again, the way of the future. So we learned quite a bit yesterday. Good trip.
Good, thank you. And I'm sorry I missed that one, but I do look forward to the upcoming tours that are being set up. And with that note, that's why I don't use these self-checkouts at the grocery store, because that eliminates a position at that store. And so I'm going to stand in line and with a clerk.
Follow up?
Yes, sir.
I tried to follow that philosophy. I found out, though, that even when they tell me to use the machine, I still have to go get them to show me how to use it.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Any other? At this time, we're going to go over to our inmate health services. Well, let's back up one time and introduce, is it physical research that are here or staff that's here?
We already did that.
Okay. We're John Petit with Inmate Health Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You all should have this presentation in your packet. We were asked last month to do a presentation on inmate health care, which is part of the idea about going on the site visit yesterday to the pharmacy. So today we're going to focus on, as part of my presentation, on the inmate medical budget, some cost containment measures you all put into place, and then the new hospitals that are operational at Central Prison and at Women's Prison here in Raleigh. And then after my presentation, Terry Catlett from the Department of Public Safety will come up and share with you some issues the department is facing and give you a status report. Just real quickly, we can't have a presentation without a pie chart. Just a reminder, this is the prison's budget from last year, $1.1 billion, and you'll see about one-fifth of that, or $229 million, excuse me, $236 million of that is related to inmate health care, and that includes the general health care, dental, mental health, as well as pharmacy. So there are a couple different ways to look at inmate health care. You can sort of see it as an optimist or as a pessimist. Here's some trend data over the past 7 years. Last year, they spent $236 million, as I mentioned, which is a slight increase from the year before, and we'll talk about some of the major reasons why. But the trends over the past few years, in terms of overall spending, it's either been flat or it's been going down. In terms of what they spent their money on last year, the largest wedge are employees. These are people who work in prison hospitals or in actually out in camps, as well as operating the two new hospitals. Prescription drugs is a very, very large expenditure. It's about 13% or $30 million of their budget. Hospital services is about 16%, and that's about $37 million, and that figure has come down pretty significantly, and we'll talk about some of the reasons why. This is some trend data as part of a report you all have directed the department to do. They must report to you all quarterly on hospital admissions. So these are inmates who leave facilities and go out into community hospitals, and so you'll see that quarterly it ranges to around 400, and it's actually down now to 335 inmates last quarter. So since October of 2011, the admissions to hospitals have gone down 20%, but the overall inmate population has actually risen by about 0.5%. In terms of the major expenditure categories, employees count for a little over half. There are almost 2,100 employees. The biggest part of that number are nurses, or nursing positions, professional nurses, as well as nursing assistants. Hospital providers, last quarter, last fiscal year, there were 104 hospitals that served inmates. There were almost 13,000 claims for almost a little over 7,700 inmates. However, five hospitals account for over half of those claims. So the department has contracts with some folks. You all have heard us talk a lot about the five prison regions and their goal when it's advantageous to actually contract with a hospital such as Catawba Valley in the Western region. Actually, they have a dedicated unit for the Department of Prisons, and so it helps.
Yes, ma'am, Representative Mullen.
Do we hold questions until the end?
It's the discretion of the speaker.
Please ask.
Going back to the previous slide.
Yes, ma'am.
You said that this last quarter, medicals for inmates had declined,
so,
although the number has increased?
So if you go back to October of 2011, so there were 417 admissions that quarter.
And just correction, we're on page 7. Is that where you're going back to?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm sorry, page 7, the inmate hospital admissions.
Yes.
So there were 417 admissions that quarter. Sort of a comparable quarter, 2 years later, the admissions had declined to 335 admissions. So the admissions have declined to hospitals, have declined 20%, but the overall prison population has risen 0.5%. So I'm just trying to give you some context.
Can you follow up? Can you share with us the reason are the inmates healthier than what they've been in the past? Because I know it seems like medicines or medications have increased for a lot of folks. So do you have any reason?
So, you know, I've often touted the wellness program they have with inmates in the past, but that's really not affecting this population. I think a lot of what you're going to hear later on has to do with a lot of people being served, a lot of inmates being served in the central prison and the NCCIW hospital, whereas they used to go out to community hospitals, they can bring inmates from other facilities to central and to NCCIW's hospitals to actually have them treated there, and we'll talk about some of the specialty clinics and things that are operating there. So I think that has a large impact on that.
Thank you. See? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to local government, let's say a sheriff's office, and the contractual arrangements you have with the hospitals, does that include sheriff?
So, Representative Graham, last year, I think in the course of our presentation in the JPS subcommittee, we had talked about the state's, the provision in the state budget that has hospital payments and other provider payments capped at 70% of bill charges or 2 times the Medicaid rate. And some members were interested in that applying to counties. And so there was a bill that passed. And I think the county commissioners have worked with the department in terms of setting up some technical assistance to actually have county jails have those same sort of arrangements. And I think that I don't know where that process is, but last time I spoke with the County Commissioners Association, they were working with the department, and the problem they were having was you've got 100 different counties and their IT systems, whereas the state has obviously just one system, and so it was a lot more seamless for the state to communicate with outside providers. But I think my understanding from the hospital, I mean from the County Commissioners Association, they were working on those barriers, but so that's an ongoing process.
Follow up. When that inmate is a state prisoner being held in a local jail?
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. That's a different matter. So if there's a jail backlog, then the state would be responsible for that. But fortunately, knock on wood, we haven't had a jail backlog in 2.5 years. So if an inmate is the opposite situation, if there's a safekeeper, a county inmate that's being housed at the state, then the county would have to pay the extraordinary medical costs associated with that inmate because they're a county inmate, not a state inmate. So 6 hospitals were paid more than $1 million, about 70% of the total, and then 57 hospitals saw 20 patients or fewer. And this has been pretty consistent data over the past couple of years in terms of the bulk of these inmates are going to a few hospitals. Prescription drugs accounts for about 13%. Yesterday at the pharmacy, we saw the three robotic machines, and they can fill at a central pharmacy over 4,500 prescriptions per day, and about 80% of that is done with robotics. And then finally, other providers, that accounts for about 8%, and those are folks who are going out to providers in the community. These employees account, it's about the third largest category of employers for the department. The largest, obviously, is going to be custody and security, and then probation, and then medical staff. So some cost containment efforts you all have put in the past.
Mr. Petit, Senator Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we get too far, five hospitals account for 55% of claims. Can you tell us what those five are?
Yes, sir, I can.
I think I could probably take a good stab at it, but I'd like to know for sure.
I need to grab that list for you in a moment, but it's going to be UNC, Catawba Valley, I believe. Let me just stop there. I'll get the list for you. So you all have enacted a number of budget provisions over the past few years. The most recent one was last budget session, directing the department to pay no more than 70% of bill charges or twice the Medicaid rate unless they have a more advantageous contract. And then they require the quarterly utilization report, which is what I was basing some of that information on. And then just to give you some budget information over the past 4 years, there's been about $42.1 million in reductions that have occurred over the past 4 years. So,
Senator Bryant.
Just on page 10, the quarterly hospital, these figures are all the reductions for each year. Ours is in black and white, so is the fact that it's in red up there mean it's in reduction?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for that clarification. Sorry about that. So it's been $42.1 million in cuts to the inmate medical budget over the past 4 years.
How do you explain it? What is that? That's attributed to what? How do we cut so much? What happened?
I'm going to get to that in a moment, sir.
Oh, okay.
If you don't mind holding that question. So one of the largest expenditures that the department has outside of employees is what we talk about, purchase services, or mainly sending inmates out to hospitals or other providers for treatment. And so if you go back to 2009-2010, that accounted for about $113 million of the department's budget. So between these new hospitals coming online and then also these budget provisions you all have put into place to cap these billed charges, because before, the department had no leverage. The inmates had to get health care. If they couldn't provide it in-house, they had to send them out to a community hospital, and so they had to pay what the charges were unless they had a contract with the hospitals, and it wasn't a very favorable business arrangement for the agency. And so $113 million in 2010, and you'll see in 2013 that number declined to about $56.8 million. And in fact, the blue on your chart, or the darker color, the $37 million that was spent on hospitals last year, the total spending on hospitals and other providers last year was $56.9 million. That's less than was spent just on hospitals in 2010-2011. So these costs are coming down dramatically. They've declined 50% since 2009 and 2010. And the reason, and we talked about this a little bit last year during the budget presentations in subcommittee, but these provisions and these new hospitals that are online are really bending the cost curve. So if you go back, the striped column on the left, for instance, the $119 million, that's what the department was billed in fiscal year 9-10 for between hospitalizations and other providers out in the community, other doctor visits. and the department paid $90.4 million, or about 76% of that. 2011, you all enacted these budget provisions, about 70% of bill charges, or two times Medicaid, and you can see that in 11-12, there were $92 million worth of bill charges, and the department only paid $49 million, or 53% of bill charges. And this past year, it declined even further, down to $92 million of bill charges and about 48.3% of bill charges. And so there are a couple of reasons. One thing that you all have done is this 70% of bill charges, this cap. And then there's also been a cooperation with the Division of Medical Assistance over in HHS for inmates that are Medicaid eligible and are sent out to a community hospital for longer than 24 hours. The arrangement is for Medicaid DMA to pay the 70% they would pay for Medicaid eligible inmates, and then the state, or in this case DPS, would pay the state share, the 30% of those charges. And so in this, they first are working on this MOU with DMA. There are about 12% of inmates they determined to be Medicaid eligible. You can see over the past few fiscal years that number has risen pretty dramatically. So now that's about fifty-one percent. Excuse me. They estimate they're averaging monthly about a little over $1 million in cost avoidance for inmates that are Medicaid eligible. So part of the issue is we have this provision that sort of caps what the department can pay. We've got new hospitals, and then we've got this Medicaid eligibility, which is why these costs are coming down so dramatically. For instance, and then finally, the new hospitals that have come online. You all have heard us talk about this a lot in subcommittee. The Central Prison Hospital has 120 medical beds and 216 mental health beds. We talked about these facilities were designed to have clinics, to have local providers come in and provide clinic work. UNC has a contract with the department to staff 14 specialty clinics, and I think Ms. Catlett might talk a little bit later on about some expansion they're currently negotiating with other providers or UNC to come in and staff even more clinics. Between January and November of last year, there were almost 9,800 procedures done at Central Prison Hospital. So what they can do is they can schedule inmates from other facilities around the state, and they can bring them to Central Prison to have them get the treatment and then send them back to their unit if it's appropriate, or they have some beds there to keep inmates until they're ready to go back to their regular units. This figure from January to November, there were only a handful of clinics online in January. The bulk of these are really from June through November. And then finally, the NCCIW facility has got 80 medical beds and 70 mental health beds, and they've got a contract for about 16 clinics. And from June to November, they have done over 4,200 procedures at the facility. So two things are happening here. One, these inmates are being treated inside a facility, so you cut down on all the custody issues about taking an inmate out to a community setting, which I know you all get lots of calls when inmates go out to facilities. It also saves the department a lot of custody money, and they can also treat people in-house. And so where people might have feigned before, they're having a heart attack. They're at Central Prison, they're having a heart attack. They have to rush them out to an emergency room. Now they can actually assess the people and triage them there and see if they actually are having a heart issue or they just want to go for a ride. And so those things are really helping contain a lot of the costs. Mr. Chair, that's the end of my overview.
Okay, questions from the committee. Mr. Graham.
Yes, sir, just one question. If an inmate has personal insurance and in a community hospital, more or less, do we bill the insurance or do we absorb the cost?
No, sir. Part of an inmate being in the custody of the state, the private insurance, they're the state's responsibility.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said there were 80 medical and 70 mental health beds at the Women's Correctional Hospital.
Yes, ma'am.
So that would be 150 people. and there's been 4,223 procedures. Are any of them going to the central prison to get anything done, or are they all using these specialty clinics? Or
so, Representative Hurley, just to clarify, when I mentioned these 4,200 procedures, these just aren't inmates who are necessarily going into a hospital bed. They could be going and seeing an orthopedic specialist, could be coming to the facility to treat the person. So these people aren't all necessarily occupying medical beds. They could just be getting sort of day op work.
Yes, ma'am.
How many at the women's?
How many inmates?
Yes.
How many inmates?
In the women's.
Third?
Would that be what? Okay.
There you
go. Not supposed.
Don't touch that mic.
Well, I have to touch it out there, and that's why I just don't know how to do it up here. Sorry. Sorry about that. Embarrass me. Is this the women?
So, Representative Hurley, these 4,200 procedures are not only women who could be housed at NCCIW, but they could be coming from other units around the state where they house females.
Okay. Thank you.
And just clarify my on the specialty, we're talking about 14 specialty as far as doctors, like an ortho, a neurologist, a gynecologist.
Yes.
Those are types.
Yes.
Or specialty.
Yes, sir.
We're not talking about a clinic set up in there. It's that particular specialty item medically.
So, and maybe Ms. Catlett can sort of expound upon this, but they've actually set up, let me, if you don't mind, can recognize Ms. Catlett.
No, I've got also some other.
Okay, so we'll just.
Yeah, and I'll wait. Yes, sir. Thank you. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. Those two sections seem to be parallel, except your last line on the women's hospital says June to November. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. So the Central Prison Hospital opened first, and the women's prison was coming online. So the delay is because the clinics weren't staffed at NCIW Hospital until June.
Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The specialty clinics, does that include dental, vision, any of those services?
So there's a dental services that are offered in prison. That's a smaller part of the overall general health budget, but inmates have always gotten dental care. In terms of there being specialty clinics at CP for dental, yes. I'm seeing Terry, Ms. Cowell nod, so yes, that includes that.
Vision.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
So, follow up.
Repeat the question. I'm sorry.
They are getting treated for visual, glasses, and those kinds of things. Thank you.
And you'll be pleased to know that the glasses are actually that inmates need are actually manufactured down at Nash Correctional as part of a correction enterprise plant.
Representative Dobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two quick questions, if I may. The Medicaid eligibility that you talked about earlier is cost containment. We started in 2010. What's the rationale for just starting that in 2010?
So there had been lots of – so the federal Medicaid system is divided up into regions around the country. And so the department had petitioned – the Atlanta region, which serves North Carolina, for years because they had heard that other states had Medicaid-eligible inmates, and the ruling seemed to have been that this wasn't permissible. So I think the department either kept being persistent or there was a change in the interpretation of the rules within the federal system, and they were able to get a favorable ruling. And then the department was directed to work with DMA to set up this memorandum of understanding about how inmates are going to be screened, how they're going to be paid. So the inmate has to be in a community setting for more than 24 hours, Medicaid eligible. So it's not every time somebody leaves the facility and they're Medicaid eligible, Medicaid pays for it. There's sort of very specific criteria. And so it just took longer than a lot of people hoped to get that system set up.
Follow up.
Follow up.
So basically what you're saying is It had been pursued for years prior to that. We were just waiting on approval or a different interpretation to go forward with it. Is that fair to say?
I think that's fair to say.
One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, please, Paul.
The 70% reimbursement of billed charges, has there been much pushback or complaint from the private health care providers on that, or is that something that they're comfortable with, or how is that relationship working?
Maybe we could hold that question for when Ms. Catlett comes up. The people who would probably be hearing the most complaints would be you all, and so I have not had feedback from members about that relationship. But maybe Ms. Catlett, when she comes up here, we can hold that question for her, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Mr. Poteet, I thank you for your time and your presentation. And at this time, we'll call Ms. Terry Catlett. And according to her agreeing, I saw her head agreeing with you, I think you told us the truth here. No, I know you work real close with the department, and if you have any questions at any time, committee, you feel free. Mr. Poteet is up on the sixth floor here. You can go by and speak with him and can answer any questions that you have. Ms. Catlett, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
Certainly. My name is Terry Catlett. I am the Deputy Director for Health Services. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon to share this information with you. And second of all, I would just like to thank the committee for their unwavering support over the past few years to pass the legislation and put measures in place to have assist us with these cost containment measures, as you've seen displayed by Mr. Poteet. In addition, I will tell you that North Carolina is the envy of correctional health care organizations nationally with the two new facilities that we have in place here in Raleigh. We have had various groups from most recently L.A. County come to our central prison and have gone back, and we will be assisting them with some of their design and build questions so they can construct a very similar facility in L.A. Other states have come, and truly we are the envy of correctional health care systems nationally. So thank you very much for that support and helping us obtain funds for those two facilities and putting the measures in place to bring these cost containment measures to fruition.
And Ms. Catlett, if I could interject, if committee, if we'll let her go through her presentation, and then we'll, if you'll write your questions down, and afterwards we'll give our guests time to respond.
Certainly. Thank you, sir. Well, I just kind of want to give you an overview of our mission statement. You can see that our mission is to provide access to quality, cost-effective health care that is rendered by competent health care professionals. And you can see some of the services that we provide: comprehensive medical and surgical, mental health, dental, and nursing. The levels of care that we provide are primary care, specialty care, inpatient care, and residential care. I'm just going to give you this afternoon an overview of some challenges that we continue to encounter as we provide our quality health care across the state. I'm going to talk about some geographic challenges, some of our staffing challenges, the aging patient challenge, our expansion of services, the activation challenges, and finally some of our long-term care challenges. Let's talk about our geographic challenges first. NCDPS is more than just Central Prison and NCCIW. We have 61 facilities across this very large state. There are 27 units that provide 24/7 coverage to include our processing centers, our inpatient facilities, our large close custody facilities, and our infirmaries. And some of those, for example, are Craven, Neuse, Fountain, Polk, Piedmont, for example. There are four facilities that provide 16 hours, 7 days a week coverage in our close custody facilities. That's in Caledonia, New Hanover, Lumberton, et cetera. There are 15 units that provide 16 hours a day, 5 days a week coverage in our medium custody facilities. And finally, there are 15 units that provide 8 hours a day, 5 days a week coverage in our minimum custody facility. So we are challenged with providing the necessary level of care in our large geographic area. In many of our remote areas, we cannot fill some of our positions, so we rely on contractual support. And the housing, the patient's housing is based on their acuity level, and so we can best utilize our resources in that particular area. We have staffing shortages in all of our disciplines, but how do we supplement DPS staff to ensure we're providing necessary medical, mental health, and dental health care? Well, we do it in a variety of ways. First, we have contracts. We have contracts with locum tenens. And let me just kind of explain what a locum tenens is. They are a third-party vendor that provides professional staff, such as psychiatrist, physician extenders to include nurse practitioners or physician assistants. We also have a contract with several travel nurse organizations. Those particular nurses sign on for a 13-week contract. We can renew it if the need is available, but they work for us for 13 weeks at a time, and it can be renewed. And we also have independent contracts. Those are contracts with an individual, a physician, a dentist who may want to work one day a week for us. He may have a practice, he may be getting ready to retire and wants to still do some primary care, dental care, and he will go into a contractual agreement with us one-on-one to provide care in that particular area. The disadvantages to having those types of contracts are continuity. Some of the folks really don't have ownership. They're not real. Sometimes we have policy compliance issues. The competency. Sometimes, you know, we have concerns because not everybody can jump into a correctional health care environment. It really takes a special person to work in correctional health care. And finally, the costs associated with some of these contractual organizations. For example, some of our locum tenens organizations, they may charge us up to $150 an hour for that particular psychiatrist. The psychiatrist may only get about $70 because the third-party vendor gets that other little bit of money. So the cost can be quite exorbitant. Well, but we have come up with some solutions. We have had some strategic repurposing of some of our hard-to-fill positions. And here's some of the strategies that we have done, and we have been successful. We have taken some of our long-term vacancies. For example, we had a dental position in Hyde County that had been vacant for up to 3 years. Well, there's really not too many dentists in Hyde County who wants to work in prison. So we've actually recently taken that position and moved it to a different part of the state where we have a much larger applicant pool. And so we are going to be successful filling that particular position now. We've already posted it. There have been applicants, and we're setting up interviews. We've also been successful in reclassifying some of our positions. So, for example, we've had a long-term vacancy psychology position in a remote area of our state, and we have reclassified that to a social work position, still within the mental health discipline, but being able to meet the needs of the population with that particular discipline. One of the other things that we're really excited about is we have recently developed some hybrid positions, and you'll be pleased to know that we had some, again, long-term psychiatry positions in some of our remote locations that we were not able to fill. I brought that position to the Randall Building here in Raleigh and have set up telemedicine equipment, and we are currently, we have two full-time positions and two contract physicians that work for us who actually Skype our inmates across the state and provide psychiatry clinic via Skyping. This past year, we have had over 6,000 Skype encounters for mental health with psychiatrists who work out of the Randall Building here in Raleigh. So we're able to still meet the needs of the population by doing our encounters, providing medication management, but using technology to be able to assist us in providing medical care. We also have some telemedicine equipment across the state in which we have physicians. We currently have a contract with East Carolina University. It's a long-standing contract. We've had the contract with ECU for now over 21 years. We, Central Prison, was the very first telemedicine encounter that ECU had 21 years ago, and we're still going strong. The next thing I'd like to talk about is our aging population. The inmates in prison are getting gray. Currently 17.4% of the total adult offender population are over the age of 50. And while chronologically they're 50, physically they're about 60 years old because of the fact that a lot of them have never received medical care prior to their incarceration and their lifestyle. So we have a very gray population. Over 36% of our total offender population are receiving care in one of our many medical chronic care clinics. John discussed a little bit about that, but we have multiple clinics. I listed a few here for you to see: cardiovascular clinic, diabetes clinic, hypertension clinic, infectious disease clinic, pulmonary clinic, to name a few. So 36% of the entire population is in one of these clinics getting care. Another striking statistic is 13% of the total adult correction offenders receive mental health treatment in the form of medication management, individual or group therapy. And this is up from 2010, that statistic was 9%. We are receiving many, many more offenders to our facilities that have mental illness. And another striking statistic is 39% of our entire female population is receiving some form of mental health treatment. The cost of pharmaceuticals, for those of you who were on the tour yesterday, you may have seen or heard this figure thrown out, but we spent last year over $30 million in pharmaceuticals. $30 million. We are part of a multi-state contract alliance for pharmacy where we get a lot of our pharmaceuticals at a discount rate. There's probably 38 states nationally that participate in this particular pharmacy consortium. But as well as you know, in addition to our antiretrovirals for our HIV patients, one of the other large costs are psychotropic drugs. And with the rise in our percentage with our mental health offenders, those costs are rising as well. Uh, Okay, I'm just going to talk a little bit about some of our challenges with our expansions. Actually, these are really great things that are happening in our organization. Certainly, John discussed the expansion of services at NCCIW. Since June, we've had several more consultants. These are physicians who come in and provide specialty care on a regular basis. And you saw those stats. Since June, there's been a little over 4,000 encounters from specialists who come to NCCIW, whether it's once a week or once a month, to provide specialty care. In Central Prison, we'll talk a little bit about that on the next slide, but there's been an enormous expansion of services at Central Prison Healthcare Complex. I want to talk a little bit about our Foothills facility and our relationship with Blue Ridge Healthcare System. About a year ago, we signed a contract with Blue Ridge Healthcare to provide inpatient care. We also asked them if they would be interested in coming into Foothills facility and providing care on site. Well, this was something a little different that they had been used to doing, but they said, well, you know, I think we'll give this a try. Well, this past year, we've been so successful. We have 9 different specialists that come into our facility at Foothills, and just this past year, we had over 1,000 encounters at Foothills, which means we had 1,000 less inmates going outside of the fence to hospitals in the western part of the state to receive care. That's pretty significant. We also this year have gone into an agreement with a couple of different physical therapy vendors who, again, come on site to our facility and provide physical therapy care, direct patient care to our offenders, so that they don't have to go out for physical therapy, whether it's post-op, they've had surgery, they've had a knee replacement, or whatever they may have had. So the therapist actually comes on site to our facilities. We have probably 5 or 6 facilities, one of them being NCCIW. Some of our facilities in the east, Alexander, Nash, Green, and we continue to expand that particular service. We'll be doing some more expansion of that in the future. So that's another way of which we can prevent the patients from going outside in the community. It's a care that they need. They've had surgery. They have to have physical therapy. So the vendor has said, you know what, we'll come to see you instead of you coming to see us. UNC specialty physicians. I cannot say enough positive remarks about the true public health partnership we have with UNC hospitals and UNC specialty physicians. Folks, these are physicians who come in, they see our patients, they develop treatment plans with our inmates, treatment plans that are continued upon their release from prison, so that when they go back into the community, we can now start building healthier communities in North Carolina. This is truly a model public health partnership. And again, we are the envy of correctional health care organizations nationally due to this significant relationship that we have with UNC. I want to talk a little bit about telemedicine. I talked about that a little bit earlier, but we are utilizing telemedicine equipment statewide for some of our clinics. We do, if we had a wish list, we would like to purchase a little bit more equipment so that we could expand the telemedicine capability, but we are utilizing the equipment that we have. And the last thing I'd like to talk about on this particular challenge is the fact that, believe it or not, we will be rolling out our electronic medical record in March. We have named this project our HERO project. That is our acronym for Healthcare Electronic Record for Offender. It's our HERO project. The test system will be delivered to us in early March. We have a 60-day window in which we'll be testing the product, and we will be rolling out the product the very first week in May in our female command at NCCIW. We're starting out with a smaller population. We have approximately 2,500 female offenders. The vendor and I, we will be working with the vendor to work out all the bugs and kinks of that particular project. And then in late summer and early fall, we'll be rolling that project out to our other male facilities. And we just can't. We are just excited beyond means and with this particular project. We have talked for years about electronic medical record, and it's really funny. When we first started our negotiations with UNC, the first thing or some of the first questions we were asked by the different providers is, do you have an electronic medical record? And very shortly, we will have an electronic medical record. And we cannot thank you enough for the ability to get us those funds so that we can launch that. The activation update at Central Prison. Let me just kind of give you some statistics and some information. We are so, again, delighted to be able to have this facility to provide services to our inmate population. As John mentioned, we moved in to Central Prison Healthcare Complex in late December of 2011. We signed our contract with UNC in November of 2012, and the physician specialists started making arrangements to provide clinics in probably mid-April. Currently, we have one more clinic to add to the numbers that John told you this morning. We got confirmation this morning that the cardiologist will be starting to come to Central Prison sometime within the next 90 days. So we're elated about that. Our operating suite, if you've not been to Central Prison, I encourage you to come visit us. We have an endoscopy unit, and we have two fully functioning operating rooms. This past year, or since April, we have conducted 176 endoscopies or colonoscopies, and we have had 244 general procedures in the one operating room. We are moving to have both operating rooms running simultaneously, but of course, you know, that takes staff. But we do have an interest. The UNC physicians are working with us so that they can have coverage back at UNC, and they'll be at Central Prison running both ORs 5 days a week. So we're very excited about that opportunity very shortly. In radiology, we had over 3,500 just routine x-rays. We had, just this past year, 912 CAT scans. One other thing that's really exciting, we have a mobile MRI unit that comes to Central Prison every Friday morning. The inmates are scheduled for routine MRIs. We'll bring them from across the state if they need an MRI. This past year, we had 222 MRIs at Central Prison. And let me just kind of put this in perspective. If you or I had to have an MRI done and we didn't have insurance, it would cost about $8,000 for an MRI. With Blue Cross and Blue Shield, it brings it down to about $1,600 that we would be responsible for paying. This mobile vendor provides us the MRI. We have digitally, it's read through our UNC contract. And our total cost for an MRI is less than $300. Less than $300 for an MRI. We also have conducted 591 ultrasounds in our radiology suite, so we've been quite busy. And again, what happens is these are routine procedures statewide. If one of our patients say out at Alexander facility or Marion, they need something routine, we go through, make arrangements with transportation to bring as many routine patients into Central Prison to have this done. It's quite a very sophisticated transportation network, and we're able to provide, again, routine studies. Now, of course, if there's a patient at Central Prison and they need that particular procedure, then we certainly schedule them as well. In our mental health unit, as John mentioned, we have 216-bed facility. We have inpatient and outpatient units. We have a couple of units that are not staffed currently, but we do have plans in the future to open up a step-down unit, and we'd like to be able to open up a dementia unit. Certainly the challenge with that, though, is it's very staff-intensive, and currently, you know, the staffing is at a premium. I want to just talk about a little bit about the staffing at NCCIW. And the clinics, as John mentioned, we have the very same clinics at NCCIW that we have at Central Prison. The UNC physicians come to Central Prison, and the same physician goes to NCCIW to provide the same care. The only exception with NCCIW is we have our prenatal clinics and our gynecological clinics. So certainly we don't need those at Central Prison. So that's why there's a little difference in the amount of clinics that we have at NCCIW. There is radiology equipment at NCCIW. We are working with UNC currently to help us staff that so that we can keep some of that equipment operational. And certainly we have some long-term care beds at Central Prison, at NCCIW. That new facility is a separate building on the grounds of NCCIW, and it's a 150-bed facility. 70 beds are mental health, and 80 beds are long-term. We also have a turnkey dialysis operation at Central Prison and NCCIW. We have a vendor that comes in and provides dialysis 6 days a week, two shifts. Some of the clinics that we're providing at Central Prison, as was questioned earlier, we do have optometry clinic, we have ophthalmology clinic, we have ENT clinic, nephrology clinic, neurology clinic, of course, general surgery, infectious disease, podiatry, orthopedics, cardiology. We have a couple of more clinics that we'll be bringing on board within the next 90 days, but we truly are about 90% operational with our clinics at Central Prison. The last thing I'd like to talk about is our long-term care needs. As John mentioned, we have 120 beds at Central Prison for med-surg patients. Currently, 20% of those individuals at Central Prison require long-term care. What that does is it has an impact on our bed census. So we typically try to bring a patient in from one of our facilities. He may be having some sort of surgery. And it may require an overnight or maybe a week stay at Central Prison, and then we'd like to turn the patient back over to his facility. But with 20% of the population being long-term care, there are times when, you know, we're in a bed crunch, and there's no place to send some of these long-term care patients. So it truly is one of our needs. Truly is one of the things that we need to look at, some long-term planning. We have had some strategic planning sessions to kind of come up with some solutions on how we manage the long-term population. Some of our solutions are, as you can see, some modifications on some of our existing facilities that could help us with some of these long-term care patients. We also think that if we could review some of our existing policies on medical parole and the extended limits of confinement, we could increase eligibility for some of our patients to be released. Currently, many correctional organizations nationally are reviewing their laws and statutes in order to increase eligibility for release. We're spending countless hours and thousands of dollars to house offenders that present a minimal risk of recidivism. And this last chart I just wanted you to take a look at is talking about the external care, total cost of external care based on age. And you can see the blue is the bar for the individuals that are under the age of 50. And the green is over the age of 50. In 2013, we spent $894 a year on medical care for those individuals under the age of 50. In 2013, we spent $3,259 on patients over the age of 50. Folks, one of the first things I said in my presentation is prison, our inmates are getting gray. The total number of inmates over 50 and the episodes of external care for this population continues to rise. Remember, the largest percentage are over 50, and the natural demographics are working against us. So we really need to quickly develop some long-range plans for the housing of our gray population. It is a national issue. It's just not here in North Carolina. Nationally, all states are struggling with the gray population. So, again, that's some of our challenges in our organization. We have some geographic challenges. We have some staffing challenges. Our aging populations presents a challenge. Some of our expansion of services, while it's exciting, it does present some challenges. We have activation challenges, and finally, our long-term care challenges. I would again like to thank you for the support that you've provided us, and as we continue to work as partners through these and realize some additional cost containment efforts. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this with you this afternoon, and if anyone has any questions, hopefully I have the answer.
Thank you. Senator Bryant?
Yes, thank you so much for your thorough presentation and your enthusiasm for what you do and what you have accomplished. Two questions, and I may have not been paying as close attention as I needed to. What does the activation challenge mean, if you could just briefly remind me?
Well, some of the challenge that we had during activation is actually just getting the facility staffed.
Okay.
Some of the recruitment efforts, some of the retention efforts in opening a new facility. Certainly in the Raleigh area, there's lots of other employment opportunities in healthcare. So finding individuals that were willing to come work in a correctional healthcare environment was a challenge.
Okay. One more question, Mr.
Follow
Chair.
Yes.
And this is for you or for the staff. It seems like I remember debating in a J committee somewhere some new provisions or updated provisions on compassionate release. If the staff could remind us of what we've accomplished with that or where we are with that, you know, if inmates become so ill as to really not be a threat, but to there was some way that where they could get paroled and there was some procedure for that, if we could get, and I don't know how that's working. Could we get an update on that? If not now, later?
Yes, give us a couple minutes, sir, in conference. I'll get back to you. Representative Alan McNeil.
Yes, thank you. Going back to this gray-in population, is this just simply because people with long-term sentences are the makeup of these ones that are getting grayer, or is the age of people getting incarcerated growing?
It's actually a combination of both. You know, we have inmates who have longer sentences, and we actually have older inmates who are being incarcerated. We have two inmates who are 87 years old, and we, in our processing centers, they're processing inmates who are in their late 60s and early 70s. So it's actually a combination of both of those factors.
Follow
and
up.
Again, that's just not in North Carolina. This is a national issue.
I guess that just means old people are mean.
No, I think you get this is a better than the Affordable Care Act here. Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation.
You're welcome.
Also enjoyed your enthusiasm. A question concerning mental health. It seems like the percentage of mental health patients, it seems, appears to be on the rise.
That's correct.
My question is, for the mental health case management, medication management, individual group therapy, are those Medicaid billable hours or services?
No, they're not. It's all inpatient. And the Medicaid billable is only is only community-based admissions. All of our mental health inpatients are managed internally.
Follow up?
I'll have to give that some thought.
Okay. Senator Allred.
Thank you. You mentioned something about routine MRIs, scheduling routine MRIs. And I don't understand that. What is a routine MRI?
Well, I may have misspoke. If there was a clinical indication for an MRI, the patient would be sent to Central Prison instead of urgently. If someone needs something done urgently, we would send them to the local community hospital. But if an orthopedist has determined there was a clinical indication for an MRI, and I failed to mention that this does go through a utilization review process before it is approved. So we currently use the same utilization review software and program that Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and all community hospitals use. So if it has been determined that an individual meets the clinical criteria for an MRI, we bring them to Central Prison for that particular procedure.
Well, please.
Yes. So just to get an overall view of this, is it true that the costs are going up as the population's going down and the hospital admissions are going down? Is that a true statement?
Community hospital admissions
I was just looking at the chart that said hospital admissions down, prison population down, costs up. Is that true?
Actually, our prison, our outpatient external admissions are going down. That's correct. The prison population, as John mentioned, has gone up. And our external spend with the help of you all has gone down.
Wait, the prison population is going up? I thought the prison population was going down.
Can we hold a minute, please? Mr. Poteet.
Yes, Sir Owen, I think the question was related to the chart that I showed that over the past 3 years, the hospital admissions has gone down and the prison population over those 3 years has gone up slightly, 0.5%. So it's still around it's less than 38,000 inmates, but I was comparing that to the hospital admissions are going down and the population has gone in those 3 years slightly.
Well, certain institutions was because the population was going down. That's all I thought I heard last session was prison population down, underutilization, shut down prison facilities.
But I think with our prison expansion, the bed capacity of some of the larger sites.
So the prisons that have been closed over the past 4 years have mainly been closed because the population overall is coming down and because you all, when you authorized these new 1,000-bed prisons to be constructed, the six, they were designed to have add-on capacity to make them more efficient. So the units that have been closing were older, smaller, less efficient units. And so that's why they've closed. So it's you have larger facilities.
I'm really just trying to get instead of looking at the tree, at the forest, I'm trying to get a picture of the whole thing, not just the, can't see the forest for the trees. So is the population in this state, prison population, going down, going up slightly, and it's the cost of hospitalization for these folks in treatment going up, staying the same, or going down?
I'm going to have Christine Leggett, please.
Representative Bowles, I think based on these questions and the confusion that's being generated, it might be a good idea to have the Sentencing Commission come in and do a presentation for y'all on what is going on with the prison population. So we could schedule that for February if that would be okay with the committee.
Follow up.
That would be great. I would like that. I appreciate the enthusiasm of the speaker, too. The only thing that kind of gets me is there are a lot of people in this state who don't have health insurance and don't have health care, and they haven't committed crimes, and they're not in prison for, 20 or 30 year or 40 year sentences or life because they killed somebody or several people. So I hope that the prison population isn't going down or staying the same with the costs going up, because we sure do have a lot of people who don't have health care who are good people.
Totally agree. And I think Senator Goolsbee and I were talking, if you're an elderly adult and you need health care, it'd be so easy to go to jail and get it.
Yeah, and if I may say just one other thing, then I'll get off. This dovetails back to my original question about that word routine MRI. Really, I understand better now, but that kind of jumped out at me. A lot of us can't afford MRIs, so.
Correct.
So if you're an axe murderer, you apparently can get one.
And your dental and your vision. And,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
So.
I have Representative George Graham.
Yes, sir. I have a question following up on Representative Mike Neal's question. If you're receiving Social Security, is that suspended if you're incarcerated?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just noticing all the different clinics that we have, and they all seem specialized. Do you have any that are general practitioners, or do some of the same providers provide for these different clinics, chronic care clinics?
We have primary care physicians on site that provide routine, sick call type, general medicine clinics. So they're primary care providers, and we have them. DPS staff provides those particular services. It's not necessarily a clinic per se. It's actually done at the bedside or during sick call. So primary care is done separately than the specialty clinics.
Follow-up, please. But do we have some, we don't have somebody comes in for diabetes alone or cardiovascular alone, or do you set a separate day for them to come in for the patients with this?
Yes. We kind of have a monthly calendar, and we, for example, we base it on the availability of our specialist. So maybe the first Friday of every month is when the ENT specialist would come in and provide care. And the physicians take a look at our calendar, they look at their calendar, and they kind of determine what day meets their needs, and then we fill them in accordingly. For example, our general surgeon comes in every Tuesday afternoon and then does his actual procedures in the operating room on Thursdays. So it's a monthly calendar. We keep everything the same for continuity, and that way we know how to schedule accordingly.
Thank you.
Representative Stevens, then I've got your answer.
I was just going to try to answer Senator Allran's question a little bit. I went online and found that in 2010, we had 40,379 prisoners. In 2011, we had 39,678 prisoners. And today, we have 37,328. So we seem to be going somewhat on a downward trend based on DPS's websites.
Thank you. Senator Bryant.
Yes. This is another question either for Ms. Catlett or the staff. Would any of these health care costs be, if we were to have expanded Medicaid coverage, would any additional of these charges be covered by Medicaid than are covered now? And what would they be? And especially in the mental health arena, in the the general health or mental health substance abuse arena. Thanks.
I'm certainly not aware of the answer of that question. I do know that if we are discussing mental health, unless the mental health offender has a medical problem, we typically do not send them out to the local community hospital. We manage all of our mental health patients internally. So as far as if they would be available for the expansion of Medicaid, I certainly, you know, I don't know the answer to that.
Can we see if staff has any information on that?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Christine Leggett. Senator Bryant, I think that for the most part, because the Medicaid eligible inmates are only those who are actually out of the prison for more than 24 hours, mm-hmm. that an expansion of Medicaid would not have any impact or would not have produced additional savings, but I don't know enough about the Medicaid expansion to answer that definitively, so we will work with the HHS team mm-hmm. and get you an answer to that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And Senator Bryant, I think we have a follow-up to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Susan Seitz, in response to your question earlier about the medical release, mm-hmm. the General Assembly did create statutes in 2008 that authorized medical release of certain inmates that are permanently and totally disabled, terminally ill, or geriatric under certain conditions, and there's a process for that. Also, in 2013, just last year in the budget, y'all put in a reporting requirement to now require them to report annually to this committee as well as JPS appropriations on how many people are considered for that each year. And that report is due by April 1st.
Okay.
So y'all should be, at least in report form, getting some information on that.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I think
it would be great
to look at that and determine if, given what the stats now show that we're facing, should there be any changes or improvements or update?
Noted.
You know, to that legislation.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, if I could. I do know that it has not been large numbers in the past couple of years, more like somewhere between 10 and 20 over the past few years at least, that have actually been released under that provision.
Thank you. Another Representative Charles Graham, Robinson County.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I have a question concerning veterans who are in prison. And my question is, if a veteran commits a crime, he's in prison, do they lose their benefits, veterans' benefits?
I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of whether they receive their benefits or not, but we are still constitutionally mandated to provide them their medical care.
Follow-up. Could we get an answer to that?
Sure. Staff is going to work on it. Hopefully, well, by the end of the meeting, I'll have a notation here.
Thank you.
Representative Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you say that reduced hospital visits have been a result of the available clinics, or is there any correlation there?
I would say absolutely. With the availability of all the clinics, and John's statistics went through November, we actually had, through December, over 10,000 encounters at Central Prison through clinics. So absolutely there has been a decrease in external visits to the community based on our internal clinics. So just at Central Prison alone, we had over 10,000 physician specialty encounters last year. And as I mentioned, at Blue Ridge, we've had over 1,000. And at NCCIW, I think those statistics were close to 5,000 specialty encounters. So absolutely it has an impact on a decrease in the amount of inmates seeking care in the local community's facilities.
Follow up?
Please.
And would that also affect the expense? Is it more expensive to be hospitalized than to attend the clinics within the facility?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Ms. Catlett, clarification, Blue Ridge.
Yes, Blue Ridge Healthcare System. That's a university healthcare system in the western part of the state, out in Valdez and out in Morganton, I think, is where the actual hospital is.
And they cover from all western to the Tennessee line?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
That's correct.
Any other? Yes, sir. Representative Spicelli.
Do you get any reimbursements from anything with regard to the patients? Like, for example, I'm retired military. If I go to the hospital, I have TRICARE. If you have veterans there or anyone else that has insurance or anything else, if they end up in the hospital there for a while, do you get any kind of reimbursements from them?
No, we do not.
don't know
why. Michelle, I think that staff is working on Representative Graham's question about VA benefits, and I think that was with the health insurance as well, and retirement health insurance. And I think we're waiting on an answer. So, any other follow-up? Okay, I think Mr. Petit's ready to answer.
I'm ready to answer one of the questions. just to follow up with Representative Speciale, there's not they're not reimbursement from private insurance companies or even TRICARE because inmates are wards of the state while they're in custody. However, there is a copay program that if an inmate says I need to see a doctor, for instance, they're charged a $5 copay. And if it turns out that's a legitimate, legitimate sick call, then they're not charged that. So it is a way to sort of contain cost. It is only $5, obviously, but most of these people do not have the means to pay the kind of copays you and I are paying.
Follow up.
I'm trying to understand the relationship, and I may be thinking simply here, but I'm trying to understand the relationship between being a ward of the state and going into the hospital and getting reimbursed. Why that would prevent it.
You're talking about going into the hospital, and if while you're...
He said they don't get reimbursed because they're wards of the state.
Right.
What, I don't understand the relationship. I don't understand why they wouldn't get just because they're wards of the state. Am I missing something?
They're going to work on that, and I saw Representative Stevens...
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I'm going to try to ask the question maybe more directly that Mr. Speciale, Representative Speciale is trying to get to. Why couldn't, even though we're required to provide health care, why can't we make ourselves secondary? If I have one insurance policy, my husband has another, there's some arrangement between the insurance company as to who's primary and secondary. If an inmate comes in and has alternative coverage, just like Medicaid or anything else, couldn't we become secondary? Or is there what would prohibit us?
Representative Stevens, Mr. Hal Pell is going to give us next an opinion here.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. The benefits, it's one of those, it depends what type of benefit. Disability compensation. Disability compensation payments are reduced if a veteran is convicted of a felony and imprisoned for more than 60 days. If you're rated 20% or more, they're limited to 10% disability rate. If it's 10%, it's reduced by one half. That's just one example of disability. Pension. Veterans in receipt of VA pension will have payments terminated effective the 61st day after imprisonment in a federal, state, or local penal institution. Apportionment to spouse or children. All or part of the compensation not paid to an incarcerated veteran may be apportioned to the veteran's spouse, child, or children, and dependent parents on the basis of need. So there's a need determination. Educational benefits. Beneficiaries incarcerated for other than a felony can receive full monthly benefits if otherwise entitled. If they're in a halfway house or participating in work release, they can receive full monthly educational benefits. So there's just a depends type of crime, and whether it's the benefits may be apportioned to family members.
Thank you. Is there a website that they could?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There is a complete website for veterans that are incarcerated, and it provides information on what benefits are lost, and it also provides information to incarcerated veterans on what to do once they're released from incarceration.
And could you share that site with us, please? There's a lot
yes,
of
sir.
Pencils ready.
It's a www.benefits.va.gov and then persona/veteran-incarcerated.
It's orange with the new khaki.
Yeah, if you just put if it had veterans incarcerated, it's at official benefits.va.gov site.
Mr. Chair.
And we can provide more if we want to have it at the next meeting. I'd provide a handout with that information.
And I'm going to have a follow-up with Stevens.
Well, Representative Olson, I don't think that went at all to my question, and maybe the staff doesn't have an answer, but could see about finding one. If you have that benefit when you come in, why couldn't it be used, billed, or charged by our facilities, particularly if we're set up almost like the Medicaid billing system or the Blue Cross billing system?
Thank you. Noted. Senator Goolsbee.
I just wanted to second that. I mean, that sounds to me like something we absolutely need an answer to, and we need to correct the law if that is not the law at this point. I wonder if the speaker can address that specific question.
Well, I think it goes back to the Eighth Amendment, where it states that we are constitutionally mandated to provide necessary care to our offenders. And I think that's pretty clear that that's our requirement.
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
I would agree with that requirement. It doesn't mean we have to pay for it if there's another form of payment that's available through benefits earned as a veteran or otherwise. So I would like to direct the staff to go ahead and research that, and let's prepare appropriate legislation if that is the case, and see what we can do about making that happen.
Thank you. And I was told by staff that they're going to get up with the insurance benefit program both here and will give us an answer in the February meeting. Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up with the last statement. I think as a body, we need to look at the legislation that can help with this situation. I don't know how many veterans we're talking about, but I'm sure there's right many. But I do want to make a comment as a comment, Mr. Chair. I know the governor is really pursuing veterans court, and it's something that I'm interested in. It's something that I'm interested in just for veterans in general, to give these individuals an opportunity to hopefully prevent incarceration as it's related to their service-connected maybe disability. But, again, I'd like to emphasize that we as a body need to look at this and try to come up with some legislation to try to correct it. I think that's a wrong.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Ms. Catlett.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. At this time,
Representative Bowles.
Yes.
I have a follow-up to the senator's earlier question, Senator Woodard's question.
Thank you.
The question was, what are the five hospitals that...
I'm sorry, yes. Senator Woodard.
That accounted for 55% of the inmates. It was, in order, UNC, Catawba Valley, Rex Healthcare, Pitt County Memorial, and Moore Regional. Those five facilities account for 55% of the inmates.
Thank you. I don't know about you all. We're going to take a five-minute break, seventh in the stretch here. So, Ann, you're teed up. I'm sorry, Ms. Preside, you're teed up. And we will take a little break. We'll be back at 2:35. All right, 2:35. Colonel, how you doing today?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
Good, very well.
Good to see you.
I always like to see the colonel in front of me instead of behind me. When they get behind, it usually costs, but it's all for the children. Yes. At this time, I think Mr. Pell would like to have a follow-up on some comments, if Mr. Pell.
Yes. Current law does not, a veteran does not forfeit their eligibility for health care. However, VA regulations, current federal regulations, restrict the VA from providing hospital and outpatient care to an incarcerated veteran who is an inmate in an institution of another government agency when that agency has a duty to give the care or services. So basically what we heard today, there is a duty for the state to provide those services. Therefore, under federal regulations, they would not receive their health benefits.
Yes, sir. Representative Spicelli.
Okay, that's taken care of. But even under other circumstances, like I was explaining to somebody, let's say I go to prison. My wife works. She's got insurance. I'm covered under her insurance. Why couldn't we recoup from that? Why couldn't if for whatever reason you had to send me out to town out to a local facility? Why couldn't we recoup for that? I mean, any scenario where we could recoup, I think we should be able to. But obviously, we have to find out what situations would we be able to do that under.
Right. We'll let the staff, Christine Leggett, please.
Yes, sir. We're going to talk to other staff who know stuff about insurance, which is not us, and get back to you on that in February.
That's
is that okay?
No. Representative Graham, you okay? Charles, you okay? Okay. Thank you. At this time, I kind of skipped around in the order, and I'd like to see if the chairs would like to have any comments. You're good?
I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're good. Okay. At this point in time, it's a great honor that we have Ms. Ann Presite with the Community Corrections Section, Chief Division of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice Department of Public Safety. And I don't see that on your name tag. It would have to be this big, wouldn't it?
Exactly.
Thank you. And thank you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you all. My name is Ann Presythe. I'm the director.
Oh. I was talking.
Excuse me. My name is Ann Presythe, and I'm the director for community supervision with adult and juveniles. I'm very excited to be here before you all and give you a very brief update on where we are with the 175 positions that we received from the legislature this past session. At this particular point, we have had 75 positions given to us, and we are in full process for having those positions hired. You should have a handout in your folder that shows the exact locations, the counties where these positions will be placed. We took several things into consideration when we were given these positions. With the passage of justice reinvestment, we immediately went to work to figure out how we could develop caseloads of 60 for moderate to high-risk offenders. When we did that, we realized we needed to change our supervision templates, so how we were going to assign our cases and handle our what we call level 1 through level 3 offender population. And when we did that, we were able to determine how many officers we would need to have a caseload of 60 per officer. So in doing that, we reviewed that. We reviewed the number of extended leaves, people we have out on military leave, disabilities, our turnover rates in the different counties. And we came up with a priority of locations where we needed positions immediately. And that's what you have before you now are these first 75 positions. I think one of the neatest things that I'm able to report is the second to the last bullet. At this point, 79% of these positions have been interviewed and are in the process of being selected and hired at this point. So we're proud of that. We have additional basic training classes that have been scheduled so that we can begin to get these folks in training as soon as they're hired. And we truly appreciate the support from this committee in allowing us to reallocate our surveillance officers to probation officer positions. That has helped with our transition. We are in the middle of that process right now. So we expect to be well on our way by the end of this fiscal year with having caseloads at that statutory goal.
Representative McNeil.
Thank you. Of these positions that you had available, do you know about how many applicants you had for it? Has it been difficult getting applicants? Have you had to go out and search for them, advertise them, or have they just been a lot of interest?
There's been an extraordinary amount of interest
for positions. We have two different types of qualifications that people can apply for. They can apply for a PPO position, which is a fully funded position for somebody who meets all of the requirements, the training and education requirements. And then we also have a probation parole associate position for people that don't have prior experience that allows them to come in and then work for a year and become a fully funded PPO position. So we have been screening. We have people screening a full week at a time. That's all they do is screen applicants so that we can have good, solid rosters of experienced and people that we believe will be good probation parole officers.
Well, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give us just a sketch of what training is involved, how long it takes for a new person coming in training before they're able to function?
Yes, sir. I can tell you that when someone is hired, the day they walk in on the job, we begin what we call an onboarding process, which means that they're meeting with someone, an experienced person, for the full period. It's a two-year period that we have with that employee. When they start with us, that's on an average somewhere between 45 to 60 days, and we get them in our basic training. Basic training is a five-week training program. When they leave basic training, they continue with mentors, if you will, but different experts in that particular county and or district, and they continue to learn the functions of the job. We have what we've created called field specialists, and this person is dedicated to follow our new employees so that they really get a nice, even integration into the position, and they're not just thrown into an entire caseload carrying a weapon, doing field contacts. They're definitely coached along the way.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question. And Representative McNeil touched on it a little bit, what I was thinking about. With regard to NeoGov, and I know probation parole is a little bit different than other positions within the department, but can you talk a little bit about that connection? Because I'm getting a lot of feedback, I'll put it that way, from back home on NeoGov. So can you just briefly touch on that with regard to probation parole positions? As far as, maybe I can clarify, as far as increased amount of applications based on NeoGov as previous, the way that we did it, more out-of-state applications because of NeoGov, those sorts of things.
I do not have those types of statistics at all. We are seeing, you know, I really cannot answer that question because I don't know exactly how many applications we were getting before NeoGov, but we are working through that process. I think there are several pros to having NeoGov. The key is how applicants are filling out the application and the screening process. So I really don't feel comfortable answering that at this point.
Thank you. For staff, Representative Dotson, staff will follow up with you. Yeah, with him or the all public. You ready now? Okay. She's not ready now. Representative Daltrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Preside, the time we were here, we were talking about an issue about cars for probation officers, the new probation officers. How are they going to get around?
My understanding is that we are working on that particular issue with the Department of Administration. As you know, each probation parole officer position has a safety package, and within that safety package, a car is included in that particular safety or package, if you will. And we are in the process of working with the Department of Administration to make sure that we have cars for all of our employees.
Follow up.
And if
does that include the existing probation officers that you presently have?
My understanding is yes, sir.
Representative Dalton, earlier, Representative Burr had mentioned about the car issue, and as of last night, myself, with Department of Public Safety in conjunction with Department Administration that they were working on this issue, and that a compromise and an agreement will be worked out either today or tomorrow. February, we will have a report from DOA, and hopefully the issues as far as replacement or the adding to the fleet issue is resolved, because you're right, we're adding new agents, and we need they need to have a vehicle. I guess on the application, it's not on there, will you provide your own car? You may get hired quicker if you do. So, but that issue is being worked out, and we will have a full report in February meeting. Senator Bryant?
Yes, my question is on the associate and the fully funded positions. Do both of those positions, I know the fully funded positions require a four-year college degree. Is that also the case for the associate position?
Yes, ma'am.
So the difference is whether they have any prior experience?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative McNeil?
Thank you. I know there's already been a lot of talk today about veterans. In your recruitment and process and your screening process, are we giving any advantage to veterans that apply for these positions? And just if we're not, I think we probably should find a way to do that.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, we should. And the first thing we're looking for is that four-year degree with the education requirement. And then in some cases, we do have veterans that come back and have had other types of experiences while in the military that give them that experience that we're looking for that makes them a qualified person for a probation parole officer position.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Al, back here.
Back sir.
Here. Mr. Payne. If I may, the current personnel manual, the state statutes provide that veterans do get a preference for state hiring. It's written into our statutes and our personnel manual.
Representative McNeil.
I was just going to say, well, and that's good, and I hope that we're considering that when hiring these 75, and, you know, because, and I know that there was a bill passed this year, the Brass to Class Act, I think, that gave veterans certain experience, allowed experience to be, you know, part of that package, and maybe it's something that we could look at as far as these jobs go.
Thank you. Any other questions before committee? Ms. Preside, I'd like to thank you for coming today, and we look forward to updates in the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I look forward to them as well.
Thank you. And this time, I'd just like to say thank you to, I'd like to call our next is Governor's Crime Commission, Kimberly Williams. Come forward, please. But at this time, I'd like to give kudos to Commissioner Geis. It sounds like a friend here to the General Assembly, and with the presentations by your department, I think we're envy of many states, and I think you're doing a great job, and thank you for containing cost and efficiency, and I thank you for your communications with this committee, and look forward to seeing you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity to present before you. My name is Kimberly Williams. I am the Assistant Director of the Governor's Crime Commission. I am presenting on behalf of Executive Director David Huffman, who sends his regards. And I'm also joined in the back by my coworker, Garrietta Prouty, who is also one of our criminal justice planners at the Governor's Crime Commission. The Governor's Crime Commission serves as the chief advisory body to the governor and the secretary of the Department of Public Safety. Before I go on, I will say that if you haven't already looked at the presentation, I do have quite a few pictures. I don't have a lot of charts and bar graphs, but I wanted to put a face on the work that we are doing at the Governor's Crime Commission. We're very proud of the work that we do at the Governor's Crime Commission, and I wanted to kind of put a face to the hard work and the dedicated body of professionals that we have. And I apologize in advance to those who may be in this room who are on some of these slides who I didn't get a chance to warn in advance. The commission is made up of 44 members to include heads of statewide criminal justice and human service agencies, representatives from the courts, law enforcement, the General Assembly, as well as private citizens. The overall mission of the Governor's Crime Commission is to serve the citizens of this state and to improve the quality of life through the enhancement of public safety, crime prevention, and improving the criminal justice system as a whole. I would like to say that the Governor's Crime Commission is a working body of individuals. We meet quarterly to discuss and assess the state of North Carolina's criminal justice system. The beauty of the commission is that the experts that are in the field doing the work are also represented around the table when making these critical funding decisions. So those who have the firsthand knowledge of the real issues facing our criminal justice system are there to make those decisions and also to take into consideration when a decision may be made that may have an adverse impact on the populations that we serve. Our current leadership, again, is Executive Director David Huffman, and the chair of the Governor's Crime Commission is Christopher Swecker. Governor Pat McCrory appointed David Huffman as the Executive Director on June 7th of 2013. Director Huffman served for 28 years as the Sheriff of Catawba County. Chris Swecker was also appointed by the governor to serve as chairman of the Governor's Crime Commission. Mr. Swecker was also a former FBI Assistant Director and Special Agent in charge of FBI operations in North Carolina. We're very fortunate to have these lifelong law enforcement professionals at the helm of making these critical criminal justice policy in North Carolina. I would also like to highlight our departmental leadership, Commissioner Lori Dollar, who is our Commissioner of Administration, Ellis Boyle, who's our General Counsel and Deputy Director, as well as Frank L. Perry, who is the Secretary of the Department of Public Safety. The primary function of the Governor's Crime Commission is to serve as the state administering agency for formula block and discretionary grant funds allocated through the Department of Justice. Each state, with the exception of Wyoming, has an SAA where critical criminal justice policies are recommended. And again, the GCC body meets on a quarterly basis to make recommendations in the areas of criminal justice, juvenile justice, and crime victim services. Each year, funding decisions are made based on a competitive grant application system. During the past decade, the Governor's Crime Commission's funding has been drastically reduced. During my 12 years working at the Crime Commission, when I first came on board back in 2002, we administered well over $40 million. This past fiscal year, we administered just slightly over $19 million. So needless to say, as federal funds continue to decrease, the Crime Commission still has to make the tough decisions on which initiatives will be supported, as well as being the best stewards of this federal grant funding. Each year, we receive over $60 million in requests for funding to the Governor's Crime Commission. Needless to say, we cannot support all of the requests that come in front of the Commission for review. That's why it's important that we have these staff of experts and the expertise around the table to make those important decisions, and we rely upon the staff of experts as well as experts in the field to allow the Commission to make informed decisions on where funding would be best spent. The governor made the charge early on in his term to address issues on providing safer schools to North Carolina, supporting our veterans who transition back into our communities, and addressing the ever-present issue of statewide gang violence through detection and intelligence. Gang prevention is currently supported by GCC via the GangNet database. This is a collaboration that will continue as we continue to improve our intelligence initiatives for gang awareness. Throughout the years, gang prevention, intervention, and suppression has been a constant amongst the various funding priorities supported by the Governor's Crime Commission throughout the years. In past years, the focus has been on intervention and prevention, and now we are focusing a lot more on intelligence and information gathering. Our current leadership is very keen on intelligence and information gathering with our Secretary of the Department as well as the Chair of the Crime Commission being former FBI professionals. Veterans Courts, and I've heard the mention of Veterans Courts a couple of times throughout these presentations. Our Executive Director has led the development of a Veterans Court treatment program, first being in Harnett County. And the objectives of these veterans courts is to divert veterans away from the criminal justice system and to reintegrate them back into civilian life. And if my statistics are correct, I believe we'll have approximately 10,000 veterans transitioning back into our communities within the next few years. Many will come back needing services. The Veterans Court Initiative is one that we are very optimistic about. Expansion counties include Asheville, Hickory, Salisbury, Harnett County, which is already in operation. And we are hoping to approach Wilmington, Cumberland County, and Durham County in the upcoming months. The Governor's Crime Commission was instrumental in providing resources to the Center for Safer Schools during their initial town meetings. And again, the Governor's Crime Commission will continue to partner with the Center for Safe Schools on safety objectives. We're very fortunate to have this Center for Safer Schools to address the issue of school safety in our state and have a dedicated division and body of staff who's looking at the issues of school safety in our state. As stated earlier, a major part of the grants administration process involves planning and research as a means to ensure the Governor's Crime Commission body is equipped to make informed decisions. Our planning process actually begins the summer of every year. During our summer planning retreats, the Governor's Crime Commission develops policy recommendations and legislative items to present before the full Crime Commission, and as well as develop funding priorities for the upcoming fall. In October of each year, we hold grant writing workshops where we invite all potential applicants to come to the Crime Commission and discuss the funding priorities that we are looking to support for the upcoming year. Our staff supports three different areas of the Crime Commission: the Juvenile Justice Planning Committee, the Crime Victim Services Committee, as well as the Criminal Justice Systems Improvement Committee. In our Juvenile Justice Planning Committee, we support programs that include after-school programs for at-risk youth, detention and suspension alternative programs to divert youth away from the criminal justice and juvenile justice systems, as well as teen courts and mentoring programs. This past year, we were able to fund 21 projects of the 75 requests that we received. We received over $10 million in requests and were able to fund a little over $1.4 million. This is a demonstration of how our grant funding in the area of juvenile justice has been drastically reduced over the years. In our Crime Victim Services Committee, we were able to fund a total of 211 projects totaling over $14 million in the areas of basic services for domestic violence and sexual assault programs, child advocacy centers, and services for underserved populations for crime victims. Of all the funding sources, the Crime Victim Services Committee has probably stayed the most constant when you compare to the other two committees in the amount of funding that has been cut over the past decade. Our Criminal Justice Improvement Committee is probably our most flexible source of funding. We were able to fund this past year 124 projects, totaling $4.6 million, and typically funded out of this committee are services for law enforcement officers, gang prevention, statewide infrastructure improvements for law enforcement, as well as prescription drug initiatives. our current leadership is very, very focused on the ethical responsibilities of the Governor's Crime Commission. And they're 100% committed to ensuring our grant solicitation and decision-making processes are fair, equitable, and inclusive of all service populations. Every year we get calls from the programs that do not get funded. And every year we have to have these tough conversations to these programs that did not get funded. So it's very important that our processes and our decision-making is transparent and that we're able to justify the programs that we did fund and those that we were not able to support at this time. The chair of our Governor's Crime Commission, again, is very, very big on wanting to know the side, every side of every decision that we make by the Governor's Crime Commission. In working with him over the past few months, he always wants to hear the bad news first. He always asks me, if we move forward, what is the absolute worst that can happen? What are the naysayers going to say? Can we say that this decision has been made fairly to all people and that everybody has had an equitable chance to compete? And if we can't say yes to those questions, then we all have to go back to the drawing board. And I can say, working at the Crime Commission for the almost 13 years, I can appreciate that candor and that level of that expectation of integrity from our current chair. And this, in my opinion, is the best part of working at the Governor's Crime Commission. We get hundreds and hundreds of grant applications every year, totaling millions and millions of dollars. And oftentimes, we don't get past the words on the page, and we don't get past the dollar amounts in the budget. So being able to actually go out into our communities and see how our federal funding is changing lives in North Carolina is probably the most rewarding aspect of working at the Governor's Crime Commission. And these are just an example of some of the programs that we've been able to support over the years in the areas of crime victim services, juvenile justice, and criminal justice systems improvement. And in closing, I would just like to say that we could not do the work that we do without partnerships, without community support, and without the dedicated professionals that we have around the table at the Governor's Crime Commission. I thank you for allowing me to speak. And any questions?
Yes, thank you. I have four now. Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. It's very educational and informative. I do have a question concerning veteran courts.
Yes, sir.
I think you mentioned several counties who are who have been approved or who are being considered for veterans courts. And my question is, what is the average grant award for those courts? If you have that information.
Well, right now we haven't gotten to the point, with the exception of Harnett County, of awarding actual grants in the other counties. They're still in the negotiation stages. But we are supporting, at the Governor's Crime Commission, one Veterans Court coordinator. And if I recall, it's somewhere in the area of $50,000 to support the work of a coordinator that works in either the Veterans Clinic or the hospital in that area, to work with the court system and the community partners to transition these veterans back into the community. So we are supporting the actual coordinator position.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Is there a cap? I know you mentioned several counties. Is there a cap or a maximum number of veteran courts that you're looking at, or is that open?
It's not a cap. I wouldn't call it a cap, but we are, the executive director is looking at the veterans population and making the consideration of the counties where the veterans court will be, whether it has a VA hospital or a VA clinic, and also the past number of incidences of veterans being involved in the juvenile justice, in the criminal justice system.
I'll follow up with her later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I think it's kind of interesting that Cumberland County was going to be one of the last ones.
We're not in any particular order, just.
Okay. Senator Goolsbee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess there's no enabling legislation for these veteran courts. I don't recall being a committee member ever addressing those. Are those simply a creation of the Governor's Crime Commission and the executive branch? Because I know we haven't dealt with any of that here in the legislature.
Yes, sir. It's an initiative taken on by our executive director.
Thank you. And I would like to meet the executive director and the chairman. Are they here?
They're not here today, just me.
Oh, they didn't come to our meeting.
No, they sent me instead. I'm sorry.
I understand. There's a medical issue. No problem. Got a question for you. I guess I'd like to sort of make a statement, if I could, Mr. Chairman. I have served as a JPS chair for the last 3 years, going on 4 years now, and this is the first time we've heard from the Crime Commission. I ask that they come in and address us. I have been appointed by the President Pro Tem. I know that Chairman Boyle serves on the Crime Commission, and I just think it's important as we go further with the new administration, as the legislative branch of government, to see to it that we coordinate our efforts more. I'm a former staff person, legal counsel for the Crime Commission many years ago when Lieutenant Governor Gardner was our Lieutenant Governor, and that was the first job I had after graduating from law school. And I guess I'm concerned about the lack of coordination. These veterans courts, I'm all for. I'm a veteran, Marine Corps veteran, proud, and I see a lot of our veterans with needs living down in New Hanover County, being a large retirement area right next to Camp Lejeune. We need to help our veterans, but it would sure be nice if that was coordinated through the General Assembly. I think we could help, not simply with money, but with enabling legislation that could make that a heck of a lot more effective. And I guess my big concern is, but for me asking that the Crime Commission come here and present to us today, and I appreciate you coming over, ma'am, we don't hear from the Crime Commission. Now, I know that I'm supposed to be appointed, and Jamie also, Chairman Boyles, and it's part of our job as liaisons to do that, but I would encourage, as we move into the future, I will not be here starting next year, but that we perhaps require reports from the Crime Commission as to the money, have direct reports over here at least once a year so that we know what they're doing and what they're thinking about and what they're funding. There's a lot of good, committed people over there and a heck of a lot of knowledge with law enforcement, if memory serves me correct. We've got a lot of law enforcement across the state. We've got private attorneys. We have legislators. We have all sorts of people over there. But to think that we've got tens of millions of dollars that's being directed with the legislative branch not having any involvement, none. I mean, I've had none over the last 3 years of what the Crime Commission's been doing. That's sad, and it should change. And I'm not blaming at all the governor. I'm blaming me. I haven't done it. And I think that it needs to be done. And I think requiring reports might be some legislation that we want the staff to look at so that we can get reports and find out what's up, and then fostering a much closer working relationship, like having the Crime Commission members maybe come and meet with us, maybe having a meeting set aside during the oversight time period, and maybe during the legislative.
I can remember in the mornings, they never presented to us. Did they?
Right, they never did. And because I don't think we ever ask them. But I do think it's important as we get into the budgeting process to get the Crime Commission over and work together. Y'all have heard me complain about the way that forfeitures take place in the state and the way that the money's diverted from the schools during using Operation Fair Share with the federal authorities so that all the money's directed to various law enforcement agencies, both at the state and local levels across the state. And we don't necessarily know where that money goes and what happens to it. So, again, I do think coordination across the board with our own executive branch, with local governments, municipalities, counties, with ALE, with SBI, with, you know, the various law enforcement agencies that are getting different monies that come in, along with the BJA money that comes in, Bureau of Justice Assistance, as I recall, that comes into the Crime Commission. I just think it's incumbent upon us as committee members to make sure we coordinate all this, because, folks, the governor doesn't make the law, no matter who the governor is, whether it's Perdue in the past or Governor McCrory now. We do, and we are the ones that also appropriate the money. This is our citizens' money that goes to the federal government that they send back to us. And I think we only get about 60 cents on the dollar in North Carolina. And I just think it's important for us to be involved and figure out where the money's going and help in any way that we can as the co-equal branch of government to direct that. So just a thought I have. I would encourage you, committee members are going to stay here a lot longer than me, to please keep that in mind, and let's, moving forward, do all that we can to work hand in hand with the executive, with the Crime Commission, which I'm about to be a member of, and I will do everything I can when I'm over there. But I would just encourage us, Mr. Chairman, to do all that we can to better liaison with the executive branch and see that this money is directed in ways that we understand, that we approve, and programs like the Veterans Courts, which I am all in favor of, are supported by enabling legislation that can help them work properly and be properly supported. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Can I go back to slide 22? Go back to slide 22. Yeah, well, there we go. I would like to add that our own representative, Sarah Stevens, is on the commission in the blue. Hey, Sarah. And I sit beside her. Representative Burr. I have Representative Burr, Senator Brown, Representative Stevens, and Senator Bryant.
Thank you, Chairman Bowles. I have several questions, but first I would just like to say, just kind of, I certainly understand what Senator Goolsbee is saying, but, you know, it's important to remember that, I mean, unless we plan on being a full-time legislature and micromanaging these individuals, I mean, just like Senator Brown and I worked to establish the new Rural Infrastructure Authority and appropriate money for them so that they can then turn around and award money, we can't be involved in micromanaging many of these groups. We certainly can have influence and change their guidance in some respects, but I don't know how much the legislature needs to be involved in micromanaging every grant that they award. But in terms of the grants that you receive from the federal government, you mentioned they had been reduced. Can you tell me, you said, I believe, that when you started you had around $40 million. Today it's around 19, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
What federal pot of money are we receiving that's been reduced? Is it, what's the name of the federal grant?
All of our grants are from the Department of Justice. We administer three different allocations that fall under the Department of Justice, one being from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which gives us our juvenile justice allocation, the other being the Office of Victims of Crime and Office of Crime Against Women, which allocates our crime victim services allocations, and the other being the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which gives us our criminal justice improvement allocation.
Did they all see, as you, I mean, you're talking about a 50% reduction in what we receive as the state of North Carolina. Were all of those federal pots of money, were they cut by 50%, or did we lose a larger percentage than other states, or are we not talking to the right folks in Washington to make sure that, you know, we're receiving our appropriate share of that money versus other states? Do you know where that stands?
This is not just in North Carolina. This is nationwide. Mm-hmm. All states have received federal cuts for different reasons. As far as the allocations that have been cut at the Crime Commission, the juvenile justice funding has been cut the greatest. Our crime victim services funding has probably seen the less cuts throughout the years and has remained relatively constant. But between juvenile justice and our criminal justice improvement grants, those are the two allocations that have seen the greatest reductions over the years. And every year, staff, we visit our delegation in Washington to actually not lobby but to educate them on how this money is needed in North Carolina. And the money is allocated through a formula. So based on our population, our crime rate, that determines the amount of money that we receive every year. And over the years, those formulas have been reduced.
Just one more follow-up. Sure. You believe nationally everyone's seen about a 50% reduction?
Well, I would say between 20% and actually 60% reduction nationwide.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't repeat what Senator Goolsbee said about the need of veterans courts and how the legislature can help, I think, with that desire, because you know, I think it is a good thing, and I think that we could get involved and help you move that forward a little quicker. I live in Onslow County, and you didn't mention Onslow County in that list, and I was a little surprised, to be quite honest, so I had to speak up. And you know, with Camp Lejeune being in Onslow County, I would have to say maybe other than Cumberland County, I got more veterans than anybody. So, I was just curious about how the decision was made, and, just thought I'd bring that to your attention because I do know the need is definitely needed in our county.
Absolutely, and I would definitely take your concern back to our executive director.
Thank you. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, and it's probably, thank you, Ms. Chair, and it's probably a good thing that I've come to speak up now, so I'm going to try to sort of go in reverse order. My understanding is that Harnett County volunteered and got the people together to do the first Veterans Court. Part of what I want to say about the Crime Commission as now, having gone to two meetings, I must be the expert in the room. Crime Commission tends to look for innovative ideas and programs. They're not intended to be long-term fixes. So if they try this Veterans Court and it works very well, they will probably bring it to us to fund. Which brings me to the real thing I wanted to say. It was sort of a combination between these two. As we watch them experiment with things, we then have to figure if we want to take them over as long-term programs. So I wanted to get this committee to take a look at something called SALSAs. And I practice law, but I'd never heard of these. And they are in just limited districts. They have been granted by the Crime Commission, and nothing was mentioned here. But I hear they're tremendous financial savings for us as a state, and it's something we may want to start looking at. What it is the state DA's office with this grant money will hire a special prosecutor to work hand-in-hand with the federal government. So they're working for the federal courts as well as the state courts, and if they can get the case prepared, it's tried in federal court, where they have longer sentences for really bad criminals. They pay the cost of incarceration, but they contribute nothing to the SALSA salary that's helping them get this prosecution. We did have this discussion on in the Governor's Crime Commission that it's not something that the Governor's Crime Commission can continually do because it's not intended to be long-term funding. It's intended to be an upstart program where you go find your own system of financing. And this group doesn't have a way to get independent financing. They don't have another source of funds. So I would like to request that we as the Justice and Public Safety Oversight, look at that and see if it's something we want to recommend trying to have the state fund.
Representative Stevens noted. I've asked staff to get up with the Crime Commission to make a presentation in March. I was at that particular meeting, and it was very enlightening, and I understand. And I think it would be great to make that same presentation here to this committee and to work on future plans. Is that okay with you? Okay, thank you. Senator Bryant.
I wanted to echo some similar sentiments to Senator Goolsbee's, but really from a little different perspective. And that is, I appreciate your speaking about your the emphasis on integrity and fairness and fair competition for the grants. However, I have found it being difficult. For example, over the years, I've understood that the priorities come out in the fall, like I don't know if that's correct, in like the October timeframe or something, the fall of the year or whenever. I've often been trying to find what the priorities are, et cetera, and get communication about that, and it's not that easy to me to get the information about what the priorities are and what the grant request, grant RFPs are, the opportunities for grant applications are. And there may be a network of folks who routinely participate in this process and get the grants, but yet in many of our communities there are also other folks who are doing work, some of this innovative work, who might could benefit. So I would surely appreciate more transparency, a forthcomingness, in terms of email information to us when the an announcement when the priorities are established and what the grant, our offerings and processes will be. Most of our other entities who offer, who do that kind of funding, make that information available to us versus us having to either remember when it comes out or go hunt for it or whatever. And I haven't experienced that kind of forthcomingness in recent years from the Crime Commission. I think there was a time perhaps when there was more money, maybe, and gang prevention was a new thing, and there were, or something, that there might have been more kind of outreach and collaboration, but it seems to have been be less and less, and perhaps it's related to the funding being less. I don't know if you have a response to that, but.
Yes, and thank you for your comments. Back in maybe between 2002 and 2005, that was when, and this is just coming from my perspective of being at the Crime Commission between 2002 and now, about a decade ago, we were able, as a staff of the Governor's Crime Commission, maybe 10 to 15 staff members would actually go to six locations around the state and conduct what we call grant writing workshops. That's where we would announce our funding priorities. We would invite any and everybody who was interested in applying for Governor's Crime Commission funding to come to these workshops. We would share this information, funding priorities, how to apply for the grant, how to navigate the system, and so forth. Since that time, because of funding cuts, travel budgets have been cut, so we're not able to do that roadshow anymore. However, our funding priorities are still listed on our website every September, and we either do a grant writing webinar or we invite people to come to the Crime Commission around October. And I do realize that, you know, and this has also been a challenge of ours, that we do rely on technology more now to get the message out in those areas that you mentioned who may not have that ready access to technology, may not receive the notification of grant writing workshops or grant writing webinars or the notification that our funding priorities are now listed on our website. So we do realize that and take that into consideration and are working to make sure that everybody is notified of our funding. But just as a point, our funding priorities are listed on our website every September.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Okay. I hear you, and yet, if unless I remember that and remember to go check in September,
yes, ma'am,
and when to go check, I wouldn't know that. So my only request is there a way that we can sign up? Is there a way to sign up on your site to get some kind of outgoing communication from your agency? Do you all do outgoing communications to any existing groups or your existing fund, you know, and how do you get on that list? And can we as legislators be a part of that email distribution or any of whatever updates you provide?
You can.
And
yes.
Is there a way and to do that from the website, or can you?
Well, and going back, talking about budget cuts and funding, we just recently had to riff our entire research team. Mm-hmm. And so they were responsible for keeping our listserv and our website mm-hmm. up to date. So we no longer have that. So mm-hmm. we're now in the process of figuring out how to fill that gap to make sure that the lines of communication aren't completely shut down.
Well, if there is a way for us to be included, I'd appreciate some information back to us. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Some information back to us about how to make that communication happen. Do we need to request to be on a list? Can you put us on a list?
Okay.
Should we just, what do we need to do?
And it's still a work in process, so we're still figuring it out ourselves.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Ms. Williams, do you have a news email newsletter that goes out?
We do not have a newsletter. We have a website that lists funding priorities.
And on the web, yeah.
Meetings and all of that.
Does it, on the website, does it have a notification notice?
We do not. We put the notifications on the website.
But you've got to go. Right. Thank you. Senator Goolsbee.
Mr. Chair, perhaps that idea that I spoke of earlier might work pretty well to answer the senator's request. Maybe we should put on our schedule to have the Governor's Crime Commission come over in October to sort of tell us what their priorities are, so we might be able to help them with those. Or September. Okay, could you tell us, ma'am, which would be the better time for you to come over and speak with us, September or October, when it deals with your priorities and what you're looking at for the coming year?
Actually, towards the end of October would be better for us.
So maybe October or December, if we could task one of our staff, maybe, Mr. Chairman.
Well, they'll be here. They'll be back in March.
Yes.
And, you're right. And they'll give us a definitive answer. Any other Representative Faircloth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Comment or two sort of between Representative Burr and Senator Goolsbee were talking about, the sort of two views on the same issue. Back in the early 70s, late 60s, when all of this Crime Commission work first started, it was conceived as a public safety and criminal justice incubator of sorts. We hear of incubators now, business incubators and what have you. And that's what was in mind at that point. And it was not meant to set policy for long-range operation of criminal justice agencies or what have you. It was sort of trial and error. Send up a good idea, try it out, see if it worked, and if so, then it should get into the policy arena. And I think along the way, we got separated from that. We haven't had the communication between the two bodies that we ought to have. I think what we're talking about here is a very healthy thing. I think that a lot of the ideas that are approved and tried by the commission will fall by the wayside. Some of them are very beneficial, and we should have those in hand and fit them into the policy of our state and move forward. So I commend you on bringing that up, Senator. I understand the views expressed here, and I think we should hear about it.
Thank you, Representative. In fact, the reason I didn't say anything after Justin made his comments were I agree with him. I don't think we should micromanage at all. I do like the idea of bringing the those things forward. Just what I find shocking and disturbing is the fact that I've had no involvement as a chair over the last 3 years with anything the Crime Commission's done, haven't known what they're doing. And when I finally came to that realization about a month or two ago, I thought it's time to get the Crime Commission over and figure out what's going on and then figure out how we liaison with them better, not in a micro, but in a macro scale, to figure out what they're up to, because I think that working together, we can do a whole hell of a lot more than working maybe on the same thing, but spending the same amount of money. And I don't like being played either. I don't like thinking that maybe there are departments or people out there that are getting funding from the Crime Commission that we're giving funding to, and all of a sudden we don't even know the duplicity that's the duplicative efforts that are going on, and we don't even know about what's happening with other monies that are coming in. So I'm hoping that we can put into legislation direct reports so that we do know what they're doing and we can be involved more, because I do care about what they're doing and I know how valuable they are. Any more questions from committee members? Sorry, Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I've listened to discussion about the Veterans Court and the Crime Commission, and I think I appreciate all the views that have been expressed, Senator Goolsbee, Representative Faircloth, Burr, Representative Stevens. I think this is a great example of why we need this communication and why I'm glad you're here. I like Senator Goolsbee didn't hear. I didn't know a whole lot about the Crime Commission. This discussion of Veterans Court, I think that's worthy of discussion and what the state's role in something like that might be. That's a serious policy decision. You know, some of us, myself, are not big fans of drug courts and family courts, and I think Veterans Court could very well be a very different thing than that. But it's worthy of discussion, and I mean that's an important policy decision for the state to make, and what involvement we may have, and we don't really need us to be going in one direction and maybe the Crime Commission going in a different direction, or us having one view of things and the Crime Commission perhaps another view of things, and we could waste a lot of money that way. We don't need the Crime Commission funding things we've cut because we think they're a bad program. You know, so I think this is a healthy discussion, and I'm anxious to learn a lot more about what the Crime Commission does too, and especially this conversation about Veterans Courts and, you know, how the pilot goes and so forth. You know, I just think we need to take – sometimes we do things that sound good and feel good but really don't do anything but spend money. And I want to make sure if we do this that that's not what we do, that we do something that matters to our veterans and to our court system. So thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Any follow-ups? I would like to announce the chairman had to make a phone call. I see that he's back now, but I do believe it is your birthday today. So we would like to extend a happy birthday to you, Chairman Bowles. It's good. I hear you turned 35 today, so that's wonderful.
I did.
Turn the mic back over to you.
That's why we had to take a break. As he get older, my bladders are smaller, as you all can appreciate. I understand, but reality is the truth. Ms. Williams, I thank you for your time. I look forward to serving on the Governor's Crime Commission with you and serving with Representative Stevens and Senator Goolsbee. And I think between us, I think we'll keep you busy. But thank you for your time. You're always welcome, and look forward to seeing you or your staff in March. Thank you.
February.
Yeah, March. I think with what we've already gone over, our February calendar is full. Okay, we're at the committee discussion. Is anyone, Representative Stevens, Representative McNeil next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so that staff knows we don't ask them to frivolously do things, I want to talk a little bit more about the handout they did with the follow-up of how much we recoup from IDS versus expenditures, because statewide the average is 15%, and there are large counties that I would think could do a lot better who are only getting perhaps 5%. There seems to be a real diversity in how much the state, the various counties are recouping. So maybe we could look at that, because if we raised our state average from 15% to 30%, then we'd have another $20 million to work with. It's not in your packet. I don't think they put it in the packet. It's online, and it's just one of those update things we have. And I've looked at it while I was sitting here, and I'm very, very interested in what we could do to improve that recoupment on IDS funds.
Representative McNeil.
Great minds think alike, because I couldn't have said that better if I'd said it myself, because that's exactly what I was going to say. I encourage all the members of this committee to look at that report. I thank staff for getting that together. I was very concerned, as is Representative Stevens, when I read that at some of the counties that are only getting 5% back in reimbursements in IDS, and I'd like to see IDS come back before us and see if they can explain or come up with some solution to that problem, or if this committee is able to appoint subcommittees, that maybe we appoint a subcommittee to look into it, because some of the percentages that are being returned are very, very concerning.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, yes. If I could, I'm going to be chairing next month's meeting, and I would encourage the committee members, and I appreciate Sarah and Alan bringing up this issue, and I'll be happy to see that that's addressed. But if you've got other things that you're interested in for next month's meeting, I would very much appreciate hearing from you. One thing I'm very interested in hearing, seeing the folks from probation and parole come over, I think Chairman Commissioner Geis has probably already left. I've been spending a lot of time in court lately watching all the probation officers sit there throughout a large part of the day bringing back probationers. And I'm, you know, we talk about Veterans Court, as Senator Newton was getting into, and I'm just, you know, our probation officers have incredible caseloads there, but between the clerks in the courthouse and the probation officers, those are people who do the real work. And I look at how much time they spend in court with the bad probationers that don't do what they're supposed to do. And if there's some way that we can recognize their time a little easier and speed up the whole process of these violations. And it's something I know that we've talked about in the past, but maybe that's something for us to address, if not next month, then in the near future, getting them over here and looking at a way. Do we have special probation courts once a week where they can come? And there's just got to be a better way, because I see them sit in court all day long, get pushed to the side when attorneys come in, you know, and it doesn't make any sense to me when they should be out there monitoring these people. And some of them have 60, 80, 90, 100 people that they're looking over and supervising. And we need attention, because all it takes is one of those people to not get addressed and the probation officer to be tied up in court and kill somebody. And then it ends up being that whole, you know, blame the probation officer. It's always the little guy on the totem pole. So I have a lot of respect for those guys and deal with them all the time and see them sitting in court hour after hour. So I would like to try to address that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. Any others for the good of the state? If not, meeting's adjourned, 3:35.